Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, Mike Thomas, co-author of the Johnny Carson biography, Carson the Magnificent, sits down with Rick Kogan to discuss the new best-selling book.
Tonight is a celebration of Johnny Carson and the new book, Carson the Magnificent, the much-anticipated biography. Yay! Thank you. 20 years, it was 20 years in the making of an entertainer who redefined late night television and reshaped American culture. Co-author Mike Thomas, who finished the project Bill Ziem started after Bill's passing, is here with Rick Kogan of the Chicago Tribune to discuss the book, Carson's legacy, and the special nature of co-writing this biography. So I want to say welcome to both and enjoy the program.
Hello, everybody. I really do think of this more than a celebration of the book, but a celebration of Bill.
Definitely.
Is there anybody in this audience young enough to have never seen Johnny Carson on TV? Really? What are you doing here? What's the matter with you?
Yeah, you dragged him.
It is, if you've noticed, a remarkable book. It's gotten incredible reviews. It got a sort of lukewarm review from the New York Times, but it got the most extraordinary kind of play, as we say in the newspaper business, from the New York Times with the cover of the book section and then a big thing in between. Mike, how has the reception affected you?
I mean, it's bigger than I ever expected. You know, you always hope for a great reception when you write a book like this. And I thought when I read Bill's portion, it was dazzling as usual. And I just hoped I could cap it in a way that, you know, people would say, okay, this is, a whole book that we want to read. So they seem to have done that so far.
You've said in the book and elsewhere that the book was three quarters finished.
Yeah.
When you got your hands on it. Take me back further before this book and before many other books of Bill's, when you were a young would-be journalist who aspired to be old Bill's Amy. What was it about you that had Bill say, I want you to work with me? What? Because
I have no
there are
idea.
People in this audience. you got to have some idea. Kevin Pang, for instance, a young reporter who came to me. The first thing he said to me, hi, I work for the Tribune. I'm Kevin Pang. Can you possibly introduce me to Bill Zamy? A lot of people wanted to meet Bill.
They did.
In his time, he was the most admired freelance feature writer in this country. What do you think it was about you?
Well, I mean, I think the fact that I just reached out to him, I wrote him an old-fashioned letter. You know, I had moved to the city.
Yeah, but you were one of dozens who did that.
I was. It was right place, right time, too. I was probably 25, on the edge of 26 when I wrote him. Back in the day, I used to write to people whose work I admired to see if I could pick their brains. And when I moved to Chicago, I found out that Bill had moved back to Chicago. I didn't even know he was from Chicago until I had moved here. I had been reading his work for years, since senior high school, early in college. And I was at my cousin's bar one night in Lincoln Park. I was reading a weekly New City newspaper, and Bill was in there as having just landed the contract to write Jay Leno's memoir. And I went, wow, he's back in Chicago. Maybe he'll let me pick his brain. And so I dropped him a letter and some of my crappy freelance clips. And, eventually it made his way to his house. I sent it to the wrong address. But, you know, eventually he called me and said, hey, why don't we meet up? And I was like, okay. And so we met up at Twin Anchors in Old Town. And I started quoting some of his leads to him, you know, my favorite magazine leads.
Always the way to a writer's heart.
I don't know. He might have been a little creeped out, but
I'll never forget that story 15 years ago. Yeah.
But it turned out he needed a little help just organizing transcripts.
So in a sense, it was great timing on your part.
It was great timing, yeah.
What did you learn from Bill? I know that could take up this whole 40-minute conversation. What did you learn from Bill all of a sudden he says, help me, work with me, collaborate in a sense.
Yeah, it was a gradual process. You know, Jay wasn't much. Sinatra, we did a Sinatra book after we did Leno. That was more research, organizing materials. You know, and then after that, we did an Andy Kaufman book, and that was a lot of reporting and interviewing as well as organizing material. So little by little with each project, I got to do more. And he never really told me this is how you do it. He just let me on the inside to see how the sausage was made. I had never made a book before.
Did you ever in those days get any kind of insight into the way that Bill wrote? I mean, not standing over his shoulder, but you would obviously you would give him material and then you would see the manifestation of that somehow. And I'm sure, as it did with any would-be writer, kind of awe-inspiring. Did you ever say, with your relationship, Bill, how did you come up with this metaphor? How did you come up with this insight? What was that like?
We never really talked like that. We talked
never
about
talked
the
about
no.
Writing.
We well, we talked about it in a roundabout way about writers we admired, and of course, you know, I told him what I admired about things that he had written. But it was very much sort of a working partnership. It was not, you know, this is great, this is horrible. It was, you know, here's the research I have. Here's, you know, what I've organized. And then he would take it and make magic with it. And, you know, Bill was not a draft guy. Whatever Bill came back with was something he had worked on for hours and days and weeks and months. So it was very polished by the time I saw it or anybody else saw
it.
So I never saw
meaning that he would never show you his drafts. No. I mean, Bill worked stories like crazy.
Of course. Yeah, you have to. But I never saw that part of the process while he was writing. So I, you know, I'm not privy to what went through his head except extreme torture.
eventually, at some point, you decide to leave that nest and go to work for the Sun-Times.
Yeah.
Where, you remember Mike writing for the Sun-Times? Did you feel lost? Did you feel empowered? How did you feel? Because Bill, I know a million writers who did nothing, they're all failures now, but they did nothing but want to imitate Bill. I want to be Bill Zamy, I want to write like Bill Zamy, and they would write one or two things sort of like Bill Zamy, and then they would become cab drivers. For you, Bill, yeah. Bill's a big, big imprint. Did you feel him, and did you feel the Zamy light as you went about your features career?
I mean, I tried to, you know, I mean, you form your own style by imitating other people's style. And I'm not sure if I tried to imitate Bill because I couldn't. He was inimitable in his style. It was so intricate and so unique. Mm-hmm. And anything would have been a parody. But I read a lot of it. And, you know, I think it really imprinted on my brain his attention to detail and the way he conducted interviews and conversations, the way he got people to sort of divulge personal things that they
might
not otherwise.
Did you ever, early on when you were working with him, did you ever sit in on his interviews?
I think a couple for some books. We were out in LA doing a few interviews, but they were always conversations. And that's another thing I took from him. There's no interrogation.
Right.
And, you know, everything is, there's no this question, this question, this question. It's just kind of shooting the breeze and gently nudging them in certain directions.
What was your relationship while you were writing? How long were you at the Sun-Times? About 15 years? Maybe?
Almost 15 years, 14 and a half years.
What was your relationship then? Would you get a call from Bill saying, my God, that was a great story?
He would read stories. And in fact, when I was going through his piles and piles of Carson stuff, I came across some stuff of mine. He'd either printed out or, you know, he'd cut out the actual broadsheet or whatever, tabloid. We were a tabloid. So that was cool to see. And, you know, emails that I would send him, he would print out. Sometimes I'd get a source for him, like, oh, here's Jerry Seinfeld's assistant. Maybe she can hook you up with, you know. So he saved everything, and it's all there in hard copy. So that was another cool thing about doing Carson. I got to kind of revisit some of our work that we did together because everything was in the same place.
You decided at one point to leave the Sun-Times. Was it why?
I mean, you know.
I could actually ask for a show of hands of everybody who's left a newspaper in here.
I mean, it was, you know, it was a phenomenal experience. I wouldn't trade
no question.
For
I
my
know
life,
that.
But I had made it through, I don't know, 10 staff cuts and
yeah.
And they offered a buyout, and it just seemed like the time to leave.
And so. Is that when you must have at some point, not saying to yourself, well, Bill Zamy writes books, maybe I can do that too. Did you aspire to book writing at that point?
I did. Well, you were instrumental in this. 7 years before I left the Sun-Times, you and I were having drinks at the old Ricardo's. What was that called? 437 Rush, I think it was called.
It's always the old Ricardo's. But yes.
Yeah, but we were talking about books, and you said, hey, why don't you write a book about Second City? And I went, oh, that's a good idea. But then I went home, and I went, oh, they're turning 50 in 2 years. Maybe something can be written. And I had read, not too long before that, the SNL Oral History by James Andrew Miller. And I went, well, maybe this can be a prequel to that second, or to that SNL history. And so I ended up doing an oral history of Second City.
The semi-drunken inspiration of Rick Hogan. And you fell into, then you did the Phil Hartman book, which is really an astonishing book. I don't know if they have it for sale. It's really an astonishing book, and I think in that way it may have set you up so perfectly to get into this, because Hartman, to my mind, is a kind of inscrutable kind of character, a complex person. It's not like writing the biography of Donald Trump, a kind of inscrutable, complex
He's much funnier.
Character.
Right.
So you say. when this book... When Bill dies, and you and I both kind of lived through parts of that, had he shown you any of this book?
He had not, no. He always said, hey, I'll send you the manuscript, but I never got it, you know.
Interesting.
Interesting. And by the time, you know, he got cancer in 2013, it was, you know, his life was upended, so we didn't talk about that at all.
Did he talk about it before? Well, while he was doing, I have to believe, and tell me I'm wrong, but I have to believe that while he was working on the Carson book, and the Carson book grew out of the last interview that Johnny Carson did with a reporter, and that's how he did an Esquire piece, and that is the foundation of the book contract, the last person to interview Johnny.
Yeah, so that was 2002. But yeah, I guess he and I would talk about it a little bit here and there. We'd meet up to eat or have drinks or whatever it was. But by that time, I was into my career at the Sun-Times and trying to build something there. I had two young kids. And so there wasn't a lot of, oh, I'm so tortured by this. I knew he was having trouble at some point with it.
But he basically, doing all this research, stopped writing his extraordinary profiles for a variety of magazines. I mean, you must have known that
he did,
something.
He wrote some great stuff before he did that. He wrote a piece on Bob Green. He wrote, what was his last?
He did. He won a National Magazine Writing Award on the talk about inscrutable Bob Green, the former columnist of the Tribune. But then he got sucked into what he called Johnny World.
Johnny World, yeah.
Where one interview would lead to another interview, and one person would lead to another person. And that is what you came to encounter when you joyfully, I think, with a bit of sadness, decided to tackle this.
Yeah, I mean, I knew he had, you know, a couple years in, he had so much material, and Johnny was so inscrutable that he started questioning, you know, his approach to this book, because Johnny did not lend himself to the easy breezy treatment of Frank Sinatra, for instance. Yeah. Johnny didn't wear his heart on his sleeve. He was an interior guy. He was something of a recluse. And Bill was really struggling with that, along with the mountain of material. He kept collecting, like he had everything.
Everything.
I went to his store.
It was like some kind of, I mean, he literally, it was like some kind of museum that he had, or it would be a museum.
Yeah. I mean, there were crates and crates of artifacts and transcripts and binders and divorce records and marriage records and accounting records. And I don't know where he got half
and old
stuff.
Show transcripts.
It was amazing. I
mean, Jesus. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, I had to pick through all that. I mean, you know, even before I started this project, I had to figure out what he had. So because I didn't even know what he had collected.
When you were approached to finish this book, and is that the approach that the Josh Karp, the editor,
yeah,
who was Bill's editor, came to you and said, hey, I'd like you to finish Bill's book? Is that?
Yeah, that's, initially he John tracked me down. I had met John Karp is now the CEO of Simon & Schuster. He was Bill's editor at Random House when he acquired the Carson book in 2005. And he tracked me down. I was able to put him in touch with Bill's daughter, Lucy. And Lucy, along with their good friend, Carrie Sechrist, championed my involvement in this and said, you know, and told John, well, why don't you ask Mike if he wants to finish the book? And so John came back to me, and I was extremely flattered, but really daunted, because, again, I didn't know what there was there, and I had not read the transcript. So,
why'd you do it? No, I'm serious about that. Why?
I did it largely to honor my friend. I mean, it was.
Were you sure? When you said, I'll be happy to look at Bill's material, were you sure that you could pull it off?
I wasn't sure I could pull it off until I looked at the material. You know, I was deeply honored to be asked, but again, he had never told me what he collected. I'd never seen it until I entered his North Side storage unit where everything was collected. And until I read the manuscript, I didn't really know what I was about to tackle. So
in
as soon
what
as
kind
I
of shape
that,
you say, when you discovered his manuscript, you said in the beginning here, it was three-fourths kind of done. Was it done in a kind of narrative way? Was it done in a way that suited what you came up with here? You can tell, I've read it a number of times.
Yeah.
You can tell when Mike is writing and you can tell when Bill is writing, and that is praise. To you. You did not try to imitate Bill.
No, that
in
would
this
have
book.
Been a disaster.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. What shape was it in?
It was in great shape. It was very polished. And we had to do very little. In fact, my job was not to do anything to Bill's portion. There was some stuff we tweaked because of fact checking and stuff that and legal and all that stuff at the end. But his manuscript, which was 75,000 or 80,000 words, was, you know, mostly Johnny's life up through the end of his New York era, but it went beyond that because Bill would flash forward and show you later parts of Johnny's life, and then he would go back to Johnny's earlier parts. And, you know, I mean, I like that style. It's not easy to write like that, because there's no giant chapter of exposition, you know, of like, here's his childhood and here, you know, it comes to you in little sort of fits and starts. So that's the way he had written his portion. I took a much more linear approach to the portion I did, which is like part six, I think, and beyond, and basically taking Johnny from New York to Burbank and through the end of his life.
You write in the book also that you had to do, and you did, some follow-up interviews. I'm very curious who you interviewed that Bill had not interviewed. Certainly, Johnny was dead, so that doesn't work.
Yeah. I was very selective about those because Bill had spent years gaining the trust of all kinds of insiders, and I felt like kind of an interloper here. And, you know, you can't just call people out of the blue. But I did hook up with some of his writers, some of Johnny's writers, who gave me extra insight into just some of the things I wanted to explore. Like Johnny did a comeback special they were going to air in 94. And I had one of his monologue writers sort of take me through all the bits that were in the piece, Johnny's reaction, what he said, and then ultimately why he didn't want to air it. So stuff like that. But I would say 99.3% of the reporting and research was done. So I had to do very little.
Were some of these people, when you called them and approached them, saying, well, who the hell are you and why are you doing this? And I've already done my bit. I think of Johnny's kids.
People were very helpful, I have to say, at least the people I reached out to, including the documentarian Peter Jones, who made the terrific PBS Masters documentary on Johnny Carson, King of Late Night. He was an immense help throughout the whole process and a cheerleader and everything else. He had given Bill full access to all of his transcripts, which we used bits and pieces of from that documentary. And so people like that were very valuable, but they loved Bill so much that the people I reached out to were very eager to help me. And I was
how long did it take you from the moment that that Bill's daughter and Carrie said, "Hey, go ahead and do this," and John Karp said, "Yes, here's a contract. I want this book."
Probably about a year. All told, I started it even before the contract was finalized. There was no time to waste. There was so much stuff to go through. I would say about a year, once you get out through all the proofs and legal and all that at the end.
What kind of pressure you must have felt, because you were dealing with, I assume, want this to honor Bill.
Yeah.
And that's a strange kind of pressure. I mean, if you write an obit, as I do about many people, it's like, okay, well, they're dead, and I don't know if I can honor them in my way till I'm satisfied. But this is different and deeper for you, I think.
It is. I mean, Bill was a huge influence on my life, in many ways. He was a mentor. He was a big brother. He taught me how to make books in the first place, and he opened all kinds of doors for me. I mean, I met you through Bill probably almost 30 years ago. I met so many people I never would have met or had the ability to associate with. And I mean, he was generous in all ways. He didn't have to be, but that's the kind of guy he was. So
I need to ask you, how many of you in here knew Bill?
Wow.
I'm sure you'll all keep your hands up when I now say, how many of you thought you were Bill's best friend? What was the reception of the manuscript that you gave to John Karp? Was there any kind of, well, we want more of this, I want more of this, or did they just take it the way you delivered it?
No, I mean, there was, I think it was mostly structural, because I was a little experimental at first, and I wanted to see if I could wrap Bill's story around Johnny's story.
Mm-hmm.
And it just didn't work. And I saw that it didn't work, because you want each story to be read as a whole and not to be broken up. So what we ended up doing is telling Bill's story in the prologue,
mm-hmm.
and then getting into Bill's portion of the book, which goes, throughout almost the whole book. And then I picked it up again at the end through the epilogue.
When you read this book, I think most of you will think to yourselves, God, what a complicated, strange guy Johnny Carson was. What did you think when you encountered him in the intimate way that Bill provided this portrait?
I mean, it was a Johnny I had never known before. I was not, the fan.
Well, Bill was incredible. You have to call him a Johnny fanboy. There's no question.
Oh, for sure.
About
and when he was a boy, even that's when it started. Yeah. He would study him. He would lock himself in his room.
I know.
And watch The Tonight Show on his little black and white television. So this was a serious, guy for him, and something of a, a mentor in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Bill even tried his own hand at hosting a show. He hosted a couple of later with Greg Kinnear. He would substitute for him. He did a show for Bravo, I think it was, right? For Second City Presents. Is that what it was called?
Yeah.
I remember. Bill saw Johnny as the most tangible of the giants that he worshipped. It was pretty much Johnny, Frank Sinatra, and Hugh Hefner. But Johnny was always his guy. I was answering another question that you asked, and I just
your answers are they go
slipped
all
my mind.
No, they work for all my questions. The Johnny that you met in Bill's manuscript, in the three-fourths of this book that you have included in here, what do you think of him?
I thought he was a much more well-rounded human being than I had ever encountered before. You know, this was always meant to be a celebrational biography of Johnny, warts and all. But, you know, I knew mostly Johnny as an entertainer. I appreciated his place in the firmament of late night, that, you know, he's probably the greatest TV star who ever lived. I'd watched a lot of his work. I didn't know much about Johnny the man or what drove him. And I think Bill got deeper than anybody has.
Do you think he found the answer? One of the things I found about this book, and I loved Bill and I love Mike and I sort of ambivalent feelings about Johnny Carson, is that Bill was in search of, for lack of a better metaphor, he was in search of Johnny's rosebud. And yeah. I don't think he got it. Maybe there isn't one. Maybe there is not a rosebud in Johnny Carson's
All you can do life. Is try to get as close as you can. You know?
No, I agree.
Yeah,
no,
that, sometimes no,
that,
you don't.
That's
yeah.
fine, but I think that may have been one of Bill's frustrations.
That he wanted to find that, yeah.
The Johnny world kept going on and on. You know, I don't know if he asked any of Johnny's friends, like, hey, did he have a sled when he was a little boy? but, you know, Johnny was a very complicated guy. And I think one of the things about the book, there was a book by one of Johnny's attorneys, a guy named Baskin, that is nothing
Bushkin.
Nothing but yeah. kind of, he's really an asshole. I've met him and talked to him, really an asshole.
And if Rink thinks you're an asshole.
Yeah. Right. You know, it's about Johnny got drunk and then he did this and then he pulled out a gun here and then he pulled out a gun here. Johnny's dark sides, I am so intrigued, as I think many of you will be too. Johnny's dark sides were considerable. You know, when one of his wives woke up, you know, bruised and battered.
That was the first wife. There were physical altercations. He would drink and become a demon. I don't know how much of that there was in the ensuing marriages, but obviously you can't excuse any of that behavior. This book, though, is a man as the sum of his parts, and I don't think it
no question.
Excuses any of that. I think it contextualizes things. You know, I don't know if that matters to everyone, but I think that's what biography should do. If you fixate just on the bad or just on the good, you've got a really shallow product.
I agree.
Yeah.
Bill was, as all of us, I think anybody who knew him knows, he was a kind and thoughtful guy. I never saw, and tell me anybody here, raise your hand again in this thing, if you saw Bill Zamy be mean to anybody.
Never in my life.
Never in my life, too. This was a kind, sorry?
Oh, right, Oprah for Spy Magazine. That's what... You're right. He always regretted that piece.
Well, who wouldn't be?
She wrote him a note after he mocked her in Spy, and it just said, "Dear Bill, I forgive you, Oprah."
You're pleased with this, are you not, Mike Thomas?
As pleased as I can be with something I've contributed to, and more so because I got to finish it for my friend. I mean, I've done a couple of books before, but this is the most meaningful one.
As I recall, neither of those books made the cover of the New York Times Book Review.
No.
No offense, I love both those books.
They did not.
One was my idea, for Christ's sake.
Exactly.
The other aspect of this is you are on a, and it's, and none of Mike's books nor mine have made the New York Times bestseller list either, as this one has at number 15 and rising.
Let's hope.
You have been on a real and good sort of public relations mill over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
I'm curious when, you know, I know Bob Surratt would have read the book and when he interviewed you, but generally the people who interview authors, their first question is, so what is your book about? Because they have not read it. Has that been true or not?
Not mostly for this one.
Really?
I have to say, I just did one this afternoon with, I think, a radio station in Boston, and he was going deep, man. I mean, he was... Yeah, all kinds of great questions. So I've been pleasantly surprised. I mean, there've been a couple, but so far not many.
How do you figure that Johnny Carson, who stopped doing The Tonight Show more than 30 years ago, and after that was barely a ghost, in the firmament. What do you make of that? I mean, the thing is, it is still true, I think, in this town, specifically of Royko, who's been gone for more than 30 years, and everybody's play is sold out, and people... What's the magic there, Mike?
I mean, I think there's an emotional connection with Johnny that there is very rare, especially with people of a certain age, you know, boomers, Gen Xers, and, you know, the clips still play online. They still play on antenna TV, and Johnny's still swirling. I don't know that he's at the forefront of...
Well, I don't know, but younger
people's minds. But.
I don't believe that the clips that, but I have not heard anybody in as long as I can remember greet me in the morning by saying, "Hey, I just watched a really funny thing about Karnak. Do you know who that was?" I go, "Yeah, I do, but how would you?"
I agree.
I suppose it's part of the intimacy of watching television while you're in bed. And reading a newspaper while you're having a cup of coffee. I am not sure that can be replicated these days. You?
No, I don't think so. That there was that communal experience, you know. He had, at one point in the late 70s, early 80s, 17 million people watching him at the same time every night. No DVRs, no streaming, you know. It was a lot of them were in bed. As Bill writes, he was the last face that flickered on their brain before they went to sleep. And like I said, they developed this emotional connection with him. And also, Johnny runs through everybody who's in late night now. He, of course, was, you know, Letterman's mentor.
Sure.
Letterman had a very different sensibility, but even to this day, he'll tell you Johnny was the greatest of all time. But he's in Letterman, he's in Kimmel, he's in Colbert, he's in Conan, another Johnny acolyte.
Yeah.
It may not be apparent to people, but there are bits and pieces, vestiges of Johnny in all of these people who came after him.
It's funny you mentioned that. There's a new documentary on Netflix about Elvis's Las Vegas concert, his comeback concert, where you have Conan O'Brien and Billy Corgan and Bruce Springsteen going absolutely insane about that concert, even though I'm not sure all of them were teenagers when they saw that thing. What do you think Bill would say to you, Mike Thomas, about, given, I know this is getting into the intimacy of your relationship with him, would he be happy with this book? I know that's a big one.
Would he be? I think he'd be happy that it's finally out in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't write like Bill. I did not finish it like Bill would have finished it. But
do you think if you encountered any writer, even though there are no real big time magazines anymore, except for good old Chicago Magazine, to be as distinctive a writer as Bill was, that cannot exist anymore, do you think? In the same way that Johnny's intimacy with viewers or Royko's intimacy with newspaper readers exists. I think that's gone.
Well, maybe it has something to do with the nature of print and online, too. You know, I mean, somebody like Bill, you really wanted to hold the magazine in your hands.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of a physical act, much more so than it is online. But, I mean, there are still great stylists today, but no, I don't think it's practiced or appreciated like it once was. I mean, you know, words are everywhere these days. Maybe that's part of it, too.
Did you, while you were doing this, young as you are, did you go back and watch old Carson clips?
Well, I did when I was doing this book. And before I was doing this, I would come across them incidentally, and I would either remember them from my youth or it was something new to me, especially comedians. I've seen a lot of comedian clips, you know, of you know, especially first shots on Carson. That's always fun to watch.
Talk about that. That's a fascinating thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, if Johnny Carson were alive today and had become president, he would be putting these comics in his cabinet by just going like this.
I mean, that would be kind of a cool cabinet, right? Like a comedy cabinet? I would
the comedy cabinet. That's what this is, right?
Yeah. Yeah, well, he was a kingmaker, even though he played that down. You know, so many people watched him. He had a lot of power when it came to giving people exposure. And so for decades, comics especially would go on that show and have their first shot before this huge national audience. And if they killed it, he let them know they killed it by either inviting them over the couch or giving them, you know, the A-OK sign or saying, you know, good stuff. That was.
See, and that OK would manifest the next day
yes,
in calls from networks saying, hi, would you like to have a series? Would you like to have a sitcom? Would you like to play Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas?
Yeah, it was incredible. And that literally happened. I mean, I think it was Richard Belzer, the comic, who called this a gesture from God.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, there you've been blessed. And the agents called and the clubs called and the shows called. And that does not
Richard
happen.
Belzer, hi, would you like to be on a show called Law and Order, which is what he did. Some of those last years of Bill's life were terribly tough, and with all due respect to Carrie, he was cared for by a remarkable woman named Jen Engstrom. Jen's parents are here, are they? That was a remarkable thing, as you well know, much better than I, but I visited Bill up there at Jen's, and he could not have made it through without her. I'll tell you that. You know that.
I do, yeah. And I just got a very nice text from her the other day and celebrating the book and Bill, and it was very touching.
My next question is, why don't you people ask some questions? Carrie?
I can lend a few things to that.
Yes,
I was with Bill from, 1996 through 2008,
mm-hmm.
and I was on the other side of this wonderful hero through everything. Bill Zemi would become his subject every single time that he was writing something. So during the Frank Sinatra days, it was all happy ring-a-ding-ding.
Those were fun days.
Those were fun, yes. During the Andy Kaufman phase, that was very strange. And I would get him bongos, and he would play that often.
I remember that.
And Carson was truly it was his obsession, but it was also worked into his psychology from a young boy. It really was the person that he looked toward, like all the comedians you just said. I mean,
yeah.
It was, and one question I had for the two of you,
mm-hmm.
So as we all know, I'm in the arts, and people say, you know, that person is a painter's painter. They also say that painting is dead. And when you both were talking just now about the good old days that I remember very well with all of you and newspaper men and everything else, how do you feel about Bill as a writer, and do you feel like you can kind of carry on his legacy of his different style and this writer's writer, as I think he is?
As Mike said, it's impossible to carry on Bill's style. Bill was a very distinctive writer. I have never tried to, and I'm sure Mike hasn't either, imitate Bill's style. It was, and it still is in this book, Gary. It's Bill. I mean, you can read a page. We could do some kind of test here and go, here's a page of Royko, here's a page of Thomas Hardy, here's a page of Gay Talese, here's a page of Tom Wolfe. They're all different. Bill's writing was unique.
He always called it a house of cards. You know, like if you pull one part out, the whole thing collapses.
Yeah.
It's that intricate. But I actually think Bill was more than a writer's writer, because while writers really admired him, he had a ton of readers who would just be dazzled by his prose. And so whenever I think of like a writer's writer or a comics comic, I think of like an insider that's kind of, you know, industry folk appreciate, which they certainly did. But
like
I think
Cormac McCarthy
beyond that.
Was a writer's writer, but you certainly didn't want to go have a drink with him somewhere.
Bill had a wide audience. Yes.
Well, Mr. Kogan, Mr. Thomas, Mr. Kogan, I read your eulogy on Bill in the Tribune. It was beautiful. And Mr. Thomas, I've known Bill for 30 years. I helped him write. I helped him do a DVD collection on Sinatra.
I remember.
He playfully called me Jimmy Vegas, and I called him the tall one. But I have a couple questions.
Sure.
In the book, Bill's skill at probing, humanizing public figures, David Letterman, he said, his psyche was squirming, dark, and exquisite. For Carson, in Churchillian terms, the proverbial riddle wrapped in mystery inside an enigma. What would Bill say about this, and what do you say about this? And I have one more question after that.
What would I say about how he described and Churchill? Yeah, I mean, you know, Carson was, I guess, the same way. He was squirming in dark and exquisite in a different way, I think, than Letterman was. You know, both sort of tortured artists in their own way. Dave, much more ironic, and I think overt in his expressions of torture. Johnny, at least on the air, was always a cool cucumber, you know, and a cool medium. And Letterman was not. You could kind of, it was part of his character. You could see him squirm on the air. So very different, but I think they did share that characteristic.
I need to ask you one quick question. With all the research, I could not tell you who Johnny Carson's best friend was. If he had one.
Well, if you ask Henry Bushkin, it was Henry Bushkin.
Sorry?
If you ask Henry Bushkin, right. It was Henry Bushkin.
He's the lawyer who...
They had a falling out.
Yeah.
I don't know that Johnny had any really tight
interesting. Yeah.
Friends. You know, he kept people sort of at arm's length. He was, you know, he was very close with some of his, you know, like his tennis coach. They would hang out
right.
together. Just sort of random guys, not industry people.
Some of the guys who played cards with.
And Carl Reiner, Steve Martin, Neil Simon. He liked hanging around them. They didn't want anything from
him. Who wouldn't, but yeah.
Yeah, and they didn't want anything from him.
Go ahead, sorry.
I'm wondering if you had to have some sort of a written relationship with the estate to finish the book.
I did not. No, Lucy, his daughter, was so incredibly helpful and generous in giving me the keys, literally, to Carson Land, to his storage locker where everything was kept. And so once I had that, you know, I just kind of went to town and rummaged through it. And no, there was absolutely no strings, no boundaries, only support from Carrie, from Lucy, along the whole process. So I was very fortunate.
Let me just ask online if there are any questions. Christopher, are there any questions online?
We don't like online questions.
It's too remote.
Too impersonal. We don't care.
Pam had a question online. What was if you knew anything about the working relationship between Johnny Carson and his writers?
Yeah, I mean, as far as Bill, you know, dove into that, you know, Johnny would have all the writers over to his house and they'd hang around in the tennis court in this little cabin he had by there, and they would write. In fact, they did that on the last night of the show aired. They gathered in their old spots in the little hut by the tennis courts and sat in their respective chairs they used to sit in, you know, forming the monologue and writing everything else for the show. And they would just bounce ideas off each other. I don't know what kind of, you know, taskmaster Johnny really was. I mean, he was tough. He didn't take junk. But a lot of them were there for a lot of years. And so, you know, I wouldn't imagine you'd stay in a place or with a man if you didn't like the job or him personally.
This book is worth it for virtually any page, but the pages about that final party after his final show at his house are make it worth beyond
that's
what
fun.
The cost is.
No
right?
executives allowed, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hi. I just wanted to ask, you mentioned as someone who grew up with Johnny Carson and is from Nebraska, so he's Nebraska nice. Do you suppose he is still loved by everyone because he was never political as opposed to today's late night hosts?
Well, he could be political, I think.
Yeah, he was political, but not in the consistent night after night, I think, biting way that they are today. I mean, Johnny played to a very wide audience, and I think he was always conscious of, you know, alienating a certain segment.
Yeah, he couldn't be a host on Fox these days, let's say.
No, but he did get into it when need be. But yeah, I don't think it was a consistent thing. But yeah, he's still loved.
Mike, I was just wondering, I knew him since I was in high school. I knew his parents. I worked for his grandfather, stuff like that. Is there a book of Bill Zamy for you or for anyone?
A book about Bill? Well, he has a collection that was out. I think Bill best exists through his work. And we have this great collection called Intimate Strangers. Maybe you've read it. It's like his greatest magazine work, including the Warren Beatty piece where he famously just sits there while his hair falls out and Warren says nothing. There are nights I dream of him still. I can't, you know, it's one of those leads I used to have memorized. But, you know, there's been some great profiles on Bill. There's a great profile by Josh Karp that ran in New City. I can't remember the date of it, but there's also a terrific one that's online now in Chicago Magazine. Ted Allen, who now hosts Chopped, used to write for Chicago Magazine. He did this terrific profile of Bill in 96, just as Bill was sort of on the ascendancy. So I would recommend those.
One last question. John Davies, a great TV producer, is in here, and there were nibbles throughout Bill's being captured in Johnny World of a TV series or film that might arise from Bill's book. Any nibbles on that?
I haven't heard any, and I probably wouldn't be the person they'd come to. So I had heard a couple of years ago Joseph Gordon-Levitt was attached to do some Carson thing, but I don't know whatever became of that. That's as recent as I've heard.
It would need an interesting person to play that role.
Yeah,
not going to be Scott Baio or something.
Never know.
Well, we've reached the 7 o'clock hour, so I'm going to say thank you to Rick. Thank you to Mike. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks, everybody, for coming.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.